What's up, everyone? This is Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. I'm Max Bowen, the host of the show. I am back with another collection of Boscone interviews. Up first, it's Annabelle Greats, who has a film career as long as my arm, along with a many, many, many years spent doing vocal training. We talk about the movies she's been in, the folks she's worked with, and just what it takes to make a really great singer. I was checking out your website, and you have a very, very lengthy film background. I saw just a long list of TV and film credits. I'm curious that how you got into doing this in the first place.
It's kind of interesting, because actually, if you look at that, the longer list are my theater credits and my music performance credits. I actually kind of thought that film wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And then I decided to try out a class. And I did quite well in it. And then I went to an audition, and I got it. It was like, I think, the second or third audition I'd gone to. And actually, I did what is called an industrial opposite Tom Boswell.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a good place to start, a very good place to start.
Tom Boswell is a very
yes.
good place to start.
It's actually still on YouTube.
Oh, cool.
But I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. it's a fire hazard kind of thing for older people.
Nice.
It was a very, very good experience.
Yeah.
And since then, I've done several. I did a lot of student films. I got a lead in a student film called Ida's 85th Birthday. And I think the only place you can find that right now is on Vimeo.
Okay.
And I did, then I got a very small part in Olive Kitteridge, you know, the series.
Sure.
I'm in the first segment, which was a fabulous experience. I got to work with Tom Jenkins. I mean, oh my God.
Yeah.
Whoa. I mean, I have to say, I have been very fortunate in the people I've been able to work with.
Yeah, definitely.
So...
Who's been your best person to work with?
God, they've all been so good.
Right.
Tom was wonderful. I had a very small part in Daddy's Home 2 with John Lithgow, who was fabulous to work with. The other things that I've done, Difficult People, they were wonderful. I have a tiny little thing in Daredevil.
Which one? The one with Ben Affleck or the TV show?
The TV show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, what scene were you in? Because I've seen that show.
The first segment of season 3.
I don't think I've gone to that one yet. Okay, I gotta watch it now.
Yeah, I'm in the... pretty close to the beginning.
Oh, cool.
And I drop a tray and scream. That's
oh,
what I do.
Darn.
And then just last year, I got a very nice small role in Free Guy, the thing that's coming out with Ryan Reynolds and Jodie Comer.
Now, did you meet Ryan?
I had 2 scenes with him.
Oh, really?
It was so cool. And another person who's so fabulous to work with.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say about Ryan... I worked with him longer and in more scenes than I have with anyone else.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And he was there every moment of every scene, whether he was on camera or not.
Oh, cool.
And that is the best thing.
Yeah.
The highest compliment you can give any actor.
It's his dedication, huh?
Oh, he is fabulous. He is fabulous. We had a good time together.
That's
we really
so cool.
did. That was one of the most fun gigs I've ever had, and a rather nice paycheck to boot.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask, like, is this kind of work, is this like your day job, is this like all you have to do, or do you have like...
My day job is really teaching people how to sing.
Okay, cool.
That's what I do, and I've been a professional musician most of my adult life.
Okay.
I started teaching classes in the, when was it, in the early 80s.
Sure.
No, I'm sorry. In the early 70s, mid-70s. at the Cambridge Center for Adult Education.
Okay.
I taught a class called Song for Non-Singers. And there are still people who come up to me, even here, and say, oh, my God, you changed my life. I remember taking that class from you. And actually, in that period, I worked with over 5,000 voices.
5,000.
25 years.
Yeah.
Five terms a year, about 100 people each term. Do the math.
You are a workhorse.
It was just a day's worth of work, you know, every week. But
cool,
the math is I was astounded when I figured it out.
Yeah.
It has given me a depth of knowledge, both intellectual, and how do you say it, synergistic, I guess. In other words, it's the knowledge of seeing people, hearing people, knowing what is going on when you hear these different things in their voices.
Sure.
Being able to see how different bodies respond to the things that I do. And that is, I think, part of what has enabled me to help an awful lot of people either overcome the fear of singing or actually improve their ability to sing.
Okay.
I'm actually proud of many of my students. They've done some really good stuff.
Have you ever taught someone that went on to become like a big deal in music?
No, no one I have taught yet has become a big deal yet. Jeff Keller, who does the music track here, is a really good singer.
Okay.
And he came to me not being able to sing very well. So he has really learned a lot. He's a very good singer now.
Sure,
he really is. You should hear him at the Shanty Sings. He's fabulous.
Yeah. Now, when someone comes to you for the first time, how do you gauge their ability or what you need to work on?
First, I have to find out what they're looking to do.
Okay. Yep.
And what their perception is of where they need to go. And then I need to hear what they do, what they can do. And both by listening and watching, I can get a sense of what needs, say, the first emphasis. With most people, it's breath. With some people, it's posture. With some people, it's relaxation. With some people, it's just being able to open up and let the sound out. And there are just all kinds of variations on that. There are twice as many problems as there are people who want to sing.
I'll bet.
Easily.
All right. Now, you mentioned earlier that you were teaching a couple of workshops here.
Right.
At Bosco.
Right.
What were those workshops for?
Singers.
Okay.
They have a large Filk track here,
yep,
as most science fiction conventions do.
Okay.
And it's the interesting thing about Filk is it was developed at MIT.
Okay.
About the time that my brother was going there. And he actually participated back in the early days, which I think is really funny. At any rate, it's to help people who like to write. And people who come here are fabulous writers.
They are.
Such amazing talent. The people who attend, who just come to the con, some of them are unbelievably fine writers. And, you know, they write these wonderful songs, but they can't all do them justice when they sing them.
Yeah.
And this is to help them do them justice.
Yeah. Do you ever give up on people when they're trying to sing? Like, have you ever had a student who's just like a lost cause, nothing you can do?
I have, as I say, worked with 5,000 voices.
Yep.
In that time, I've worked with one person who really could not overcome the problem. Just one. There are a couple of very, very rare, I guess, disabilities, they're not serious disabilities, that make it very difficult to sing,
sure,
if not impossible.
Yeah.
One cause can be emotional trauma, which just makes it impossible to release that part of the body. And you have to be able to release you have to use your whole body, and you really have to be able to release from the jaw down to below the shoulders. And the other is, if you, some people you will hear talk, and they talk something like this, and they may occasionally do that, but they talk like that. That's a good sign that that person is not going to be able to learn to sing, because the ability to change pitch is one of the things that's built into the human body. That is how we can say, how are you? How are you?
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing. And the some people just don't hear the difference. Mm-hmm. And it's, as I said, 5,000 voices once, one person.
That's an amazing percentage.
So it's pretty amazing. It really is.
It's really astonishing. Yeah. You know, when people come to you, are most of them looking to get into being a musician, or looking to sing with choirs or chamber music?
It's a lot of variants.
Sure.
Some people, in the classes, it was just people who really wanted to be able to sing, to join other people and sing, you know. I'm not doing classes so much anymore, and I find now I have people who really love to sing and want to learn to sing better.
Sure.
I have people who, I think that's most of it.
Yeah.
Occasionally I've had people who have been trying to overcome some disabilities.
Sure.
And sometimes we're very successful, and sometimes we're partially successful. And, but mostly it's people who just really want to get better. And yeah, if somebody comes to me, and we're working for several years, I give people 2 to 4 years, depending upon the problem.
Yeah.
And they're not getting better, I will say, if you don't start practicing, I'm not going to teach you anymore. Because if you don't practice it, it doesn't get better.
It's interesting that, that you mentioned that you're getting 2 to 4 years, because most, like, I would assume it wouldn't take that long, but obviously learning to sing is a very lengthy process.
I do it that way because I feel that, first of all, as I said, there's two bases for this.
Sure.
I don't always know what the physical trauma is. More frequently, I'll get that from people's information. And I certainly don't know what the emotional trauma is.
Yeah.
And I'm not a shrink.
Yep.
There is a little bit of that in what I do. In the beginning, just coming every week will cause improvement. And that usually happens. That usually lasts for 2 years.
Okay.
After that, if you're not practicing, you get to this plateau and you can't go beyond it. And I will give someone a couple of years to sort of kind of get on the groove, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it, you know, it, I haven't, I only threatened to fire someone. I've never had, they've never, and that got them back on the track.
Okay.
So I've never actually fired anyone for not practicing.
Nice.
And I have some, I have a student now who's just wonderful, and, you know, she's so much fun because she actually practices.
It's what you got to do, though. You got to put in that work. You can't just
show
up to class, say, okay, I'm done. I don't think about it until next week. You
gotta keep doing it. That's right. I was telling a friend of mine who also teaches about this, that I had that I was having a lot of fun with a new student who practices, and she said, what? That I would like one of those.
Yeah. I'd like to go back a bit to the acting.
Okay.
I'm very impressed by all the folks that you've worked with.
Thank you.
Is there an actor that you haven't worked with that you absolutely want to?
There are probably, you know, 50 or 60.
Oh, dear.
So I really, you know, go on to names. That would be an awfully difficult to do. I know what I'll tell you.
There we go.
What I'm looking forward to doing... Yep. Is doing more comedies.
Okay.
I would love to work with some of the older women.
Okay.
You know, Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda, those kind of people.
Yeah.
I would love to work with Sean Levy again. He's a director.
Yeah.
He's fabulous. And There are a lot of other people, a lot of directors. Wish I could come up with some more names, but I can't. But
so
yeah,
cool, like your career is this like who's who of Hollywood, it sounds like.
Well, not really. There's an awful lot of people there I haven't worked with.
I've
been very fortunate. What I've been extremely fortunate with is that in so many, I don't have a huge quote-unquote Hollywood television resume, but I've worked with some of the best people around in the times that I've worked. So that's really fun. It's really wonderful.
Well, Annabelle, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Max, for inviting me. I'm really pleased.
You're
and
welcome.
I can't wait to hear this.
Thank you.
Up next, it's author E.C. Ambrose, who has two new books out, The Nazi Skull, Part 2 of the Bone Guard series, and The Singer's Crown, The Author's Cut. This is a re-release in which she added 35,000 words, and she talks all about how this changed the story, as well as the research part of the Bone Guard series.
Which is actually kind of like a re-release, right?
Because it is.
It's like the original version's out now.
Right. Because when I submitted the book, they wanted it to be shorter, and it was frustrated by some of the cuts I had to make.
30,000 words worth of cuts, right? Does that understand it?
Well, I added 35,000 words back in,
wow.
But it was about 70,000 words of cuts.
Oh, my God.
So I lost a subplot. I lost a lot of the character dynamics, the protagonist relationship with his religion. A lot of that just ended up on the cutting room floor, so
okay.
I was very pleased to finally get it back.
Yeah. So, like, taking those out, do you feel like it really took a lot from the story? Do you have to make like other changes to kind of cover up the fact that those things were removed?
Some, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. But it's an interesting process because it helped me understand the structure of what I had written.
Sure.
So the subplot that I ended up cutting, one of the secondary characters is basically on the hero's journey, including the journey to the underworld and the return with new knowledge, which I'd completely been unaware that I was doing. Mm-hmm. So it was great to sort of go, oh, that's what was going on in my head.
Right, yeah.
And it
about that part,
probably
right?
made me a better writer, having to think through how to do those cuts and how to manage the changes that had to be made.
Because I think, from like what I hear, that's a pretty common thing. Like most writers go through when they submit their books to their editor, they'll say, "Okay, this is going to go, that's going to go." And sometimes it winds up being a ton of stuff just cut out.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of like think on their feet and say, "Okay, how do we tie up all these like new loose ends that have been like created?"
Right. I think now I've changed my process a lot. When I was doing that, The Singer's Crown and The Singer's Legacy series, I was very much a pantser, writing by the seat of my pants, writing when the muse took me. And now I generally have a pretty specific outline in advance. I do a lot of historical research, so I might have a timeline that I'm following. And as a result, the books are a lot tighter. And often when they get to the editor stage, the editor's like, okay, well, I need a little more here, or this didn't feel integrated, so I'm actually expanding the drafts. I'll submit at 92,000, and the book comes out at 100,000 instead of the other way around.
Nice. So you're like more of like a planner these days.
Yes,
absolutely. But do you find that your books sometimes will take like jumps that you didn't really expect, and so you kind of like deviate from the plan, or do you stick to it? Like,
there are always changes.
Sure.
Oftentimes, I think of the plan as being sort of the skeleton, and all mammals basically share a very similar skeletal structure, but they are very different on the outside. So I may begin with that structure, but there's going to be changes. There are going to be things that I discover. I learn more about the characters. I want one character to have a stronger role, or I discover something new that I need to incorporate. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a flexible frame.
Nice. What does this new like re-release version of the book have that the first one didn't?
A lot more of Finbar, who was possibly my favorite secondary character ever. He's the one who ended up doing that hero's quest thing, which was interesting. And a deeper spiritual relationship. There's a goddess-based religion, which my editor at the time fundamentally didn't understand.
Okay.
Every time something religious or spiritual happened in the book, she would say, "I don't get this. Why is this here? What's going on?" And so rather than try to improve on those things, well, you know, I need to lose 70,000 words anyway, I might as well just cut them.
Yeah.
So they went, and now they are back, and I think it adds another dimension to the text.
Okay. Do you think you'll be doing this with any other books?
Probably not.
Okay.
I I hope to not ever have that experience again, right, where I sign a contract that makes me remove things that feel like parts of the soul of the book.
Oh, wow. Okay. But
the mantra at the time was, it's just the first contract, it's just the first book.
Sure.
And I did some things I probably shouldn't have done, as one does when one is young, I suppose.
Okay. I'm curious how you were able to like re-release the book, what changes happened that you were now able to do this.
I'm not sure why they finally stopped defending it, but every year I would send them the reversion letter and say, hey, you know, people are telling me they can't buy the book. Larry Smith would say, we can't get it. Obviously, the book is out of print. You should give me the rights back. And they would say, nope.
Wow.
For 3 or 4 years. They had reverted. The other book was back. I had my other two, books 2 and 3 in the series, and I don't know why they were being bullheaded about it, but they were. So finally last year, they said, okay.
Just kind of like out of the blue, they said, sure, no,
yeah, I don't know. Maybe shake up in leadership or whatever happened on their end that they were finally willing to release it.
So is this like one of the risks that writers take when they sign contracts, that they may find their things suddenly change without their really wanting to be the case?
Sometimes. Definitely it was a contract I shouldn't have signed. There were some aspects of it that made it very difficult for me to maintain a career in the early days, which was frustrating, a learning experience all around. And nowadays the reversion clauses are much more specific because there were a number of cases like this. The book came out a little bit before ebooks really became huge and sort of took off. So now we sort of understand more the implications of what it means to be in print from the author's perspective. And I will be much more fierce and cause my agent to do so as well to make sure that I don't end up in that situation again.
Okay, okay. Now you also got a new book out in the Bone Guard series, which is called The Nazi Skull.
Right.
Which the name alone, I want to read it now. It's just like, a Nazi skull? What's this all about? And this is your Grant Casey adventure.
Right.
What has changed with the character from book one to book two, without giving any kind of spoilers?
So, in book one, we don't find out a whole lot about Grant's past. We know that he was raised partially on a reservation, that he left there as soon as he could, and that he has a very contentious relationship with the grandfather who raised him. He basically hasn't spoken to his family in about 15 years.
Wow.
So book two begins with a break-in at the tribal center in which his grandfather is beaten and left for dead. And he gets the call. One of his coworkers basically insists. DA tells him, no, you got to go. You have to go to Arizona. You have to can't just leave this situation, you know, leave your grandfather in a coma, not ever go home. So sort of reluctantly he goes, and what he finds out is that what they've been describing as vandalism is in fact a robbery.
Oh.
So he gets drawn into a situation down in Arizona, which now has become eerily prescient with some of the other events going on in Arizona right now, and has to sort of confront his past and work things through with his family and feel what it feels like to have family.
Okay.
All right. So definitely, you know, growing and changing the character is part of the fun for me in generating this kind of series.
Okay. How would you see your characters in general grow as your books progress? I guess I'm wondering, like, do you kind of like foresee the changes, or they're like a little more organic?
It's usually fairly organic, but there's an interesting exercise called one-word character arcs, where you think about what your character's progress is going to be over the course of a book or over the course of a series, and you just put one word to it. So you might have, you know, farm boy, fighter, pilot, rebel leader, right? Those are technically two words, but that's okay. Farm boy will let you pass. But the Dark Apostle books, my titles actually do that. Elisha Barber, Elisha Magus, Elisha Rex, Elisha Mancer, Elisha Demon. So one-word character arcs right there in the title. Nowadays, I'm more likely to do that deliberately, to have an understanding of where the character goes in a closed arc series like that. So the Bone Guard books are pretty open-ended. It's a series of adventures. But the characters also have a lot of baggage. They have a lot of relationships, and those things change and also change them. So part of it is sort of looking ahead and saying, oh, when I discover a connection in one of the books, I think I'm going to use that later on. So there's a lot of Goonie, who was an important secondary character in the first book, is back in the second one. And while I was doing that, I discovered a little bit of his past that's probably going to inform, I think, book four comes around again.
You're that far ahead, huh?
So, oh, nice. And then, of course, I had a great title come to mind, and I thought, I got to use that.
Yeah, of course.
Grant's Tomb.
Oh.
So that's probably going to be book six or seven, I'm picturing. But because it's an open-ended series, it's hard to say. I can't necessarily pin down the character growth phases the way that I might with a different kind of book.
Okay. Now, you're talking about books like six and seven, but you've currently released book two.
Right, and I'm working on book three now.
The series, it sounds like it's going to be a very, long-running one, huh?
That's certainly my hope.
Yeah.
They are a lot of fun to write. I love doing the research, so right now I'm reading up on Byzantium and the history of the Crusades and things, and it'll probably, again, the original Boneguard book, The Mongol's Coffin, came out of research I did for an epic fantasy novel set in China during the Mongol invasion. And I thought, I could use this research and do something else with it, a completely different kind of book, so I wrote The International Thriller, and now it's going to probably go the other direction. The research I'm doing into Byzantium for a Boneguard novel will probably result in a fantasy novel as well further down.
Sounds like fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just kind of dig into all these different things.
Wow, look at that. That's so cool.
Yeah. How long would you say you spend researching before you actually write the book?
That's an interesting question. Probably a couple of months. Wow. Sometimes it's very formal and deliberate. So what I'm doing right now, I have the general parameters for the information that I need and the kinds of resources I need to marshal. Sometimes it's more a result of finding a cool article and then tracking down a couple of books about it. And I don't necessarily have an idea going in that I'm going to write a book, but it's a rabbit hole that I want to dive down and explore. So definitely. There are things always sort of percolating along. I actually just realized that one of my research interests into the history of clockworks that sort of keeps popping back up again. Mm-hmm. So there's probably another book that will be coming along there, and I'll pick back up some of those the threads that I left off previously.
Cool. Have you ever had someone contact you saying that you got something wrong with the research? Like, oh, this date's actually incorrect, or this person's kind of incorrect? Because I imagine they're all kind of history nerds are kind of pouring through it, oh, is this right? Is that right?
Sometimes the history nerds are super useful, especially the World War II people, because they have really elaborate websites that are highly detailed. So for research purposes, I can go there first.
Nice.
In terms of getting things wrong, interestingly, a lot of people think they know, but they may not have full information. Even in the copy edits for one of the later books in the Elisha series, I have guns in warfare, which is, in fact, period to 14th century Europe. They were new, they were exciting, and they hardly ever worked. But I thought that was really interesting that technology was rising at that time, and we don't necessarily associate it with that. So the guns were very much there in the first book. They kind of fade a little bit in the second book because there's not a big battle. They return again later on, and my copy editor said, well, guns are not really period, and she cited a history.com website. So I went to the history.com website, and it's inaccurate. Their published timeline of the history of firearms is inaccurate, and I can point you to the resources. So I basically sent them an email with footnotes. Well, you need to look at the Royal Army at Leeds because they have examples of firearms from England. We have textual evidence that Edward III was making gunpowder in the Tower of London. I could quote them chapter and verse. Needless to say, they never got back to me.
Might be a little embarrassing for them. head us back for all this time.
They need to go on their website and they need to make it right.
Exactly.
Because if I can prove it, and I'm just a casual, I sort of describe myself as an amateur historian. I'm sure that the other history people are out there gnashing their teeth. And
yeah, right. oh, God.
I mean, as we often do at the History Channel.
Yeah. I'm sure they do. Thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it. But where do folks go to learn more about you and to get your books?
So, Amazon, obviously, your local indie bookstore. Mm. My website is rocinantebooks.com, which is the name of Don Quixote's horse.
That is so cool. That is, I love. So your life is just this series of just cool historical facts, right?
Oh yeah, pretty much.
Nice.
Yeah. And occasional rock climbing. I'm also a rock climbing coach.
Wow.
Hey, what's up? This your girl, Molly McCoy, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout, your home for the best in music, movies, and a whole lot more.
Rob Green and I got the chance to talk about his debut book, The Light Years, which deals with an arranged marriage and the discovery of long-held secrets. Rob talks about the world-building process and how it felt to have his first novel out for all the world to see.
Okay, Rob, so why don't we start by telling me about your new book out, Light Years, which is being released on February 11th. What's this one all about?
It came out earlier this week. What it's about, it's kind of an arranged marriage 1,500 years in the future that may or may not lead to faster than light travel.
Damn. Where'd the idea come from?
It came in the shower, actually.
Where all good ideas come from.
So I was actually coming home from a Boscone maybe in 2014, and I was just taking a shower and just kind of thinking about, you know, all the panels I've been to, and this idea of this relativity arranged marriage thing popped into my head, and I wrote a short story, and the short story was called Love in the Time of Light Speed, and I read it at the next Boscone as part of a competition, and one of the editors there, one of the judges, said that it should be a book, and if it's a book, I should send it to her. So I said, well, I'll write a book, and I wrote a book, and, you know, long story short, she didn't publish it, but eventually Angry Robot picked it up, and there it is, yeah.
And how did you find them?
I didn't have an agent at the time, but they have, every couple of years, they do, like, a cattle call where, like, you know, they'll take on unagented submissions. So I was one of about 1,500 people who sent in November 2017, one of three allegedly who survived. It took them 444 days to judge, and I was counting every single day. Yeah, and then it's just, you know,
checking your email like every day, like
kind of, yeah. Well, you know, because you can check out your submissions on Duotrope, or you can check out, you know, Absolute Right, and there was a, you know, people were saying, I got my notification, I didn't get a thing, and everybody else is trying doing a thing, so I was just waiting to see who was the last cow out of the barn, and I was one of them, so that's kind of cool.
Nice. Now, you have gotten a lot of great reviews for this. Tons of great reviews. Does that make you at all, like, apprehensive as you approach the release stage? Does it kind of make you wonder, like, okay, is it going to actually live up to the hype?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, the good reviews, I have a harder time handling than a bad review. You know what I mean? Because of that reason. Because, like, you know, if people say it's great and then people go out and buy it and they don't like it, then it makes me feel like maybe I didn't live up to my expectations or something like that.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and there's always the worry that I'm going to start believing my own hype. And I do my best not to believe my own hype because I know what an idiot I am. You know, so, you know, all idols have feet of clay and I know my feet very well, you know.
Sure.
So.
So this has been out at the time of this recording. This has been out for, what, like 3 or 4 days now? Okay. Have you gotten any new reviews or feedback?
I've gotten a fair amount of feedback. I've got a bunch of people on Twitter who have, like, they've posted pictures of the book. They've talked about, you know, how they like the audiobook because the audiobook came out at the same time, which is cool. And I've got a couple of new reviews that have kind of trickled in, which is pretty neat. And I've had some Uncanny Magazine just published an article I wrote for them about heroism as a form of competency that kind of alludes to kind of what was going on in the book too. So there's been a lot of fuss, yeah.
Now, you mentioned that there's an audiobook out, too. Who's doing the narration for this?
Do I know the names? No, I don't know the names. I know it's two people because there's the chapters in the book go back and forth between the main male character and the main female character.
Yeah.
So there are two narrators. They're both English, so of course they sound very smart. And I haven't listened to it, and I wish I could tell you the names, but apparently they're doing a nice job.
Now that the book is out, do you ever, like, look back and think, oh, man, I should have done like this differently? Or are you, like, you set with it, you're satisfied, you're good to go with it?
I think I'm good to go with it. I think the question now becomes, if it's popular enough, is it worth doing a sequel, you know? So I've got kind of kind of a beginning of an arc in like the first couple of chapters in my head, but it all depends on, you know, whether or not those come to life kind of depends on what people are looking for, you know.
Did you write this with like a sequel in mind, or did that sort of like come about as you proceeded with the story?
I think it kind of came about as it proceeded with the story. The way it kind of works for me is the book kind of starts talking to me. You know, and it hasn't quite shut up yet. You know, still telling me there's a little bit more story. There's more story on the other side of the end of this book, and that's kind of neat. You know, so even though I'm working on some other projects now, I still kind of hear the characters like just kind of, you know, suggesting what comes next, which is kind of neat. It's a good place to be in.
Yeah. Tell me about the world in which the story takes place, and how long it took to kind of build all the different parts of it.
I wrote the book, the first draft of this, in like spring 2015, and I do a lot of my first draft work on a typewriter, so I can just kind of like crank without worrying about Twitter or any of that kind of stuff. So I think most of everything that came out in those typewritten pages ended up in the book. And in fact, when I think about the short story had six characters that were also kind of like begging to be in the book too. The world is, you know, it's not our world, because, you know, the idea being in the 200s, the 2200s, 2300s, we had to leave the solar system because the sun was about to flare and, you know, make a mess of us. So over,
as it does.
So over a couple of generations, we left the solar system and found another place. And, you know, it's 1,000 years after that. And some of the fast ships have been, you know, at this new place for a couple hundred years, and some are still arriving. And, you know, it's all about, like, you know, if you were lucky enough and rich enough to be on one of the fast ships, then you got to stake out your claim first, and everybody else is kind of like sloppy seconds, kind of like the way the world works. You know what I mean? So it's kind of a refugee story, because some of the other planets, they didn't work out so well. The terraforming didn't work out so well. Maybe on purpose, maybe not on purpose. It depends,
ooh,
you know.
Is that possible, like, sequel fodder?
Maybe, nice. Yeah. You know, the idea being that, you know, we, as colonizers, we tend to continue colonizing, whether or not we intend to or not, you know. So, yeah.
So this kind of like looks back on like the founding of like the country, maybe, because how we like kind of pushed into the West and just took everything.
Kind of like that, yeah. It kind of explores that idea a little bit.
The characters, how do you keep them memorable? How do you keep them like not becoming cannon fodder for some action scene?
Well, I think one of the cool things about this particular book is I was teaching high school at the time. So my head was for 12 years full of these different interesting, diverse characters crawling around through my brain that wouldn't let me sleep and wouldn't let me do anything.
That's a problem.
Yeah, well, I think it's part and parcel of being a teacher. Sure. You always take it home, and you're always having an argument with that little Johnny who hasn't finished his homework, and you're trying to figure out a way to show him the school's important, you know, so you take that argument to bed with you. But a lot of those... a lot of those kind of characters, no specific kid, but a lot of that kind of gestalt, diversity, kind of interesting, emotional kind of stuff showed up in the characters eventually, you know. So there's a fair amount of diversity among the characters. I mean, because it's the future, you know. The future is going to be, you know, far more diverse than today is in terms of, like, who we are and how we relate to each other and our relationships and that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of that kind of was inspired just by, you know, looking across the classroom, and there's the kid who speaks, you know, Persian as a first language, and there's the two kids who speak, you know, their Spanish as their first language, and there's the kid who's, you know, just decided that he's trans, and there's the kid who just came out as gay. And it's like, you know, that's the microcosm I was kind of soaked in while writing this. And I think that's an advantage that a lot of people don't have in their regular life. It's like a lot of people just hang out with people like them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, schools are like their own, like adventure universe.
Yeah.
And there's so much happening there, especially, I think, at like the high school level.
Mm-hmm.
If the school has all kinds of different, like, clubs and groups and so forth, it's just like its own little town, really.
Yeah. It's very exciting. You know, and that's one of the things. I stopped teaching about a year and a half ago, and that's one of the things that I kind of miss, because now I just kind of hang out with my friends, a lot of whom are kind of like me, you know, and my cats, who are also kind of like me, I guess, in terms of reclusiveness. You know, so I miss that kind of like that constant surprise. You know, like, you know, who am I going to meet today, and what weird kind of outlandish idea are they going to bring to the table?
And that's, I think, also like being here is it is a chance to kind of like soak in that whole like writers community. So when you do come to events like Boscone, what do you usually look forward to the most?
I've been coming here for, I guess I was talking to my wife. This is maybe our 11th or 10th Boscone, and it's changed a lot. When we first came here, it was getting very gray, you know, like gray hair. You know, it was like the, you know, it was kind of, there was some talk about it dying out. But in the last maybe 5 years, it's also really diversified. You know, there's a lot more young people. There's a lot more people of color. You know, the panels have really kind of like expanded and stretched out. So what looked like it might have been kind of a dying convention, because they were talking about the 50th being the last, has really become something kind of spectacular again, which is really exciting. So I love going to the panels and hearing, you know, new books. I'm always writing down notes about things I haven't read. There was a guy this morning talking about the future of asteroid mining, and of course I had to go and check that out because, you know, who doesn't want to know about the future of asteroid mining? And this is the only place that I would find something like that, I think. So,
and like, you never know where you're gonna find the idea for the next book. You might say, right. Oh yeah, asteroid mining. That's a great scene for like chapter 7 or what have you.
It all goes into the hopper. You know, it all goes in, and you know whether or not it comes out or not, it's in there somewhere. So it's a great opportunity.
Well, Rob, thanks for talking to me, man.
Yeah,
I appreciate this.
Yeah.
But where do folks go to learn more about you and to get your book?
Yep. Well, my website is rwwgreen.com. That's GREENE.com. I also tweet at rwwgreen. Or if you want to check out the book, buy Angry Robot. It's angryrobotbooks.com. And it's I'd love to talk to anybody.
And how is the audiobook available?
Audiobook available is mostly through Audible, I think. So that's how people are getting it. Yeah,
I'm down the rabbit hole too.
Yeah. So audiobook's available on Audible. You know, the ebook is available wherever you get ebooks. I've been trying to push people to buy the paper book at independent stores because I love independent bookstores. You know, so you know, you may save a couple of bucks on Amazon, but you're not funding a community. So, you know, get out there to your local independent store and buy it there, if you will. So.
Hi, this is singer Kate Eppers, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout.
Last up, it is Sarah Smith for her book Crimes and Survivors, available April 15th. This book is set in the time of the Titanic, but it goes far beyond that story, into crimes against the human spirit and how to survive them.
Let's start with some of the history behind your books, Crimes and Survivors, and it's actually available later on in April.
April 15th.
That's right.
It's a Titanic book.
That's right. So this all takes place on the Titanic, but it's not about the Titanic. It's actually kind of dealing with a family history.
It takes place partly on the Titanic and partly in New York afterwards.
Gotcha.
And it's about surviving. That happens to people when something terrible, ultimately terrible, like the Titanic happens to them.
Okay.
And?
But the character in this book, she kind of like discovers the fact that she learns that her grandfather is African American.
That's right. And it's 1912. She's not sure that he's African-American.
Yeah.
That being suspected of it in 1912 is just as bad. And I use the word bad very advisedly, in quotes, as being African-American. So, of course, she first says to herself, it can't be. I don't like this.
How could it affect someone in that time period? Are we talking like, you couldn't get work, you couldn't marry. What are some of the impacts?
Oh, it was terrible. This was the height of Jim Crow. You could not marry. She could not marry as a black woman, a white man, mm-hmm. whom she is in fact married to. She couldn't do what she is trained to do, which is to do classical music. She wouldn't have her agent. She wouldn't be able to stay in most hotels. She could buy clothes, but she could not try them on. She could not eat in most restaurants.
That's insane.
That's prejudice.
And that's what it was back in 1912.
Yeah. And but I wrote this because I had a niece, and let's call her Janie because that's not her name. She was adopted to look African American because she was. All of the rest of her family was white, and everyone thought that they knew who she was because they could see what she looked like.
Huh.
And it was dreadful for her because she was always being asked these questions that undermined her individuality as a single person, as a person who just was herself.
Yeah.
And then she had a child, and because the father is white, and the child got the short end of the melanin stick, this child is African American, and he's more or less my skin tone, and I'm white. So again, people are making your business their business. They're asking who you are, and I thought it would be fabulous to have a woman who has always thought of herself as white.
Yeah.
Think about those questions.
So this woman wants to track down her grandfather. She wants to like meet him and basically say yes or no.
Yeah.
And this all happens on the Titanic.
It happens before on the Titanic.
Yep.
And of course, he's a man, so he's a first class man, so he's not going to get on the lifeboat. She gets on the lifeboat. Now she has to ask the question of his family.
Wow.
And his family have even more interesting reasons for not telling her what really happened than he did.
Wow. So this is her quest, basically, to determine the family and what happens and why she never knew?
And why she never knew. Wow. And his wife would have been somebody who is now very liberal, very very much pro the rights of other people. And why did she betray him? And why? There are potentially two people, one of whom is African-American. What is the relationship of those men to their mothers? So it's really a lot about family, but it's also a lot about surviving.
Now,
how do you take these potentially devastating things and learn to live with them and survive with them, past them.
Now, is that what you said? This on the Titanic, because that theme of like survival.
Basically, I wrote about the Titanic because I love the Titanic.
Gotcha.
And I always wanted to write a book about the Titanic.
Cool.
And then when I thought, okay, it's Titanic time, this woman walked into my life, as characters do, and she said, my name is X, and I am an American living in Paris, and I suddenly realized after my father died that he had a brand, ES, on his shoulder, escaped slave.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, that's cool. What does she do now? That, unfortunately, what she would do now is just shut up about it. And then I realized that I had the right situation, but the wrong person.
Okay.
The person whom I really wanted to have ask this question is someone who has the twin motives of, I want to protect myself, I want to protect my baby, I want to protect all of my family, and I want to find out what happened. I want to know the truth, no matter what I do with it afterwards.
Wow. Now, back in this time, obviously, you couldn't just go online, search your family history. You couldn't do the whole 23andMe stuff.
No DNA.
How did she learn about her family? How did she gather all that information?
She basically becomes a detective.
Oh, cool.
And that's another cool thing. Women detectives in 1912.
Didn't exist, right?
Oh, yeah, they did.
Oh, really?
And the reason they got away with it was because they were invisible. There are a couple of women detectives in the story. One of them is an African-American woman, a nice middle-aged, traditionally built woman, who makes her living as a detective, but she pretends to be a cook.
Huh. Damn.
So she hears everything from the servants.
Sure, yeah,
and
of course.
No one ever suspects her.
Wow.
And there's another much younger woman who can pass for white and sometimes does and is being recruited to be an operative for what's essentially a black detective agency.
Hmm.
There were black detectives at that point, and they mostly the black detectives would hire white employees. The white employees would pretend to be their employers, and the black detectives would pretend to be the servants.
My mind is blown by this. It really is. I had no idea. So obviously, you know this air history really well. But in writing the book, did you learn anything new?
Yeah. And this is where it makes a difference being a white woman writing about an African-American history. I did do a lot of research, but I had to do a lot of research because there are things that you would know as an African-American, like Jack Johnson couldn't go on the Titanic.
Hmm.
That if you're white, you're clueless until you do a lot of the research.
Wow. Huh. This is so cool. Now, you see why
historical fiction is a little bit like science fiction.
Yes,
it's in a different world.
Yeah. You're just like creating this entirely new world here.
Uh-huh.
How long did it take to kind of build that world? I mean, obviously, you're basing on the real world. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like building the characters, how long did this take before you actually started writing the book?
Oh, man.
A long time.
Yeah, and I kept doing research. I like that period in history, and so I read about it for fun anyway. That I did a lot of research. I read memoirs of African American detectives at the time. Read a lot about New York City at the time, and just asked as many people as I could get to talk to me.
Did you ever like go back and like change the story because maybe you learned something new? Oh, a bunch.
Yes, I'm guessing a bunch. Let's not even talk about that. Let us say only
your editor's like, come on.
Let us say only that it took longer to write the book than it took to build the Titanic.
Oh dear. Was it hard to say, okay, we're done with this thing, given that your research kept opening new doors? Like, wait, let me look into this thing one more time, let me talk to this person one more time, see what else I can figure out?
I have a book that I learned to write that is all about all of the cool things I found out that I couldn't fit into this book.
It's like a compendium for it, right?
It's like a side piece. It's a book called Election, which is about the election of 1912.
Oh, cool.
Again, from the point of view of an African-American detective who gets hired to shadow one of the candidates.
Okay. You know, I'm curious. You know, obviously, a lot about the Titanic, about what happened, how it happened. Do the movies get it right? Are they largely accurate, or do they just take all kinds of crazy liberties?
Depends which movie.
Okay.
Cameron is pretty good.
Yeah.
The things like Rose giving Cal, I think it was, the finger.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
That wouldn't happen.
That the actual Titanic is really good. I know a couple of people who worked on the movie.
Oh, cool.
And these were people who, like Cameron, had actually gone down to the Titanic. And they knew the Titanic. I mean, they knew the pattern of the tiles in individual rooms. because you can find that stuff out.
Yeah, that's detailed. That's very detailed.
And I have a fairly large shelf full of books about getting it right. And then you know what's right, and the only details that you actually use are the details that the characters notice.
Hmm. Would you like to go down there and see it?
Yeah.
I love that there's like no hesitation there. It's like, yep, take me down there.
Yep. And this is somebody who gets seasick on a bridge. But I would sit there feeling really bad.
Really?
For hours for a chance to see the Titanic with my own eyes.
Oh my God. I would love to see it too, actually. I read like a lot of history books about it. You know, it's really cool what happened after it sank. You know, what happened to, like, the company, the captain, all that jazz. There's so much, like, after effects from that.
Oh, yeah. Some of the women on the Titanic had PTSD for the rest of their lives.
Well, yeah. I can only imagine, especially being in the water. Well, the people in the water, too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, the people in the water didn't drown. They mostly froze to death.
That's right, yeah.
Which meant that they were alive for 15, 20, 30 minutes, and the women in the boats had to listen to their husbands screaming.
That's right, yeah.
The mothers occasionally had to listen to their children screaming. And here's my my protagonist. 23 years old, she has an 18-month-old child, and she is listening to children screaming while she's safe. It affects her for the rest of her life.
Yeah, and she's already got a lot to deal with, you know, learning this,
yeah.
For her, potentially devastating knowledge uh-huh. about her family.
But it feeds together.
Yeah.
You either say to yourself, okay, this is the end of the world, and I'm going to retreat for the rest of my life, or you say, I really screwed this up. I need to think better. I need to feel better.
Sure.
I need to live in a better way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping she would do that, and she did.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, you are, this book is historical fiction, and you're here at Boscone, sci-fi fantasy convention. But as you mentioned, historical fiction, science fiction, very similar. Is this your first time here?
No.
Oh.
I've been here for over 30 years. I try and make it every year.
Oh, cool.
Because I love science fiction as a fan. I actually met Ian Ballantyne here.
Mm-hmm.
And then when my first book was published, it was published by Ballantyne. I still have his business card, and he was so nice.
Very cool.
It's the science fiction community is such a wonderful community.
Who are you reading right now?
Golly, right now I'm rereading Sebastian de Castell, who wrote a wonderful four-book series called The Greatcoats.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like 21st century Alexandre Dumas, The Three Musketeers.
Yeah.
And it's so sly and so... It just skewers the whole idea of epic fantasy.
Yeah.
I read K.J. Parker, who is Tom Holt in disguise. I just read Eric Winter, Rage of Dragons. Who else am I reading? Kim Stanley Robinson, of course. I got to be a fangirl for Stan Robinson last night.
Oh my God, I love it. I'm kind of a fanboy for Brian Keene, Jonathan Mayberry.
Oh yeah,
I would lose my mind if I met him. I would just dissolve into a puddle.
Man, you gotta come to ReaderCon because he comes.
I can't promise I won't squeal a little bit.
It's all right. You can squeal.
Yes. All right. Well, Sarah, this has been awesome talking to you, but where do folks go to learn more about you and, of course, to get the book, which is available on April 15th?
Well, on April 16th, there's going to be a big Titanic party in Brookline at the Brookline Main Library. We are going to have a Titanic exhibit, including a little piece of Titanic.
Like an actual piece of the ship?
Actual piece of the ship.
Ooh.
I mean, little.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a lot of stuff about things you didn't know about Titanic. and there'll be munchies and people showing up in costume and a cake with a ship going down in it. And it should be fun. So April 16th at the Brookline Public Library, 6 p.m. tour of the exhibit, 6:30 to 8:30, we'll just get together and do a party and have fun. If you're interested in finding out more about it, you can find out more at www.sarahsmith.com. SarahSmith.com. If you like Titanic, hope you'll like this book.
Well, folks, that brings us one to a close. Again, big thanks go out to the folks at Boscone for having me back. I had a wonderful time, and to all the authors who sat down to talk to me. You can follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout, Twitter, Instagram, Citywide Max, and at citywideblackout.blogspot.com. Listen to the show on Podbean, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and every Saturday at 10 p.m. on Boston Free Radio. Keep those ears open.